This podcast is brought to you by Switchboard, providing peer-driven support services for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender and gender diverse, intersex, queer and asexual people, their families, allies and communities. Switchboard Victoria also has a dedicated queer, trans, intersex people of colour program. You can find out more at switchboard.org.au. This podcast is proudly made with the support of the Victorian Government.
This podcast was produced on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Bunurong peoples of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to Wurundjeri and Bunurong elders past, present and future. We wish to extend this respect to the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander queer community, sister girls and brother boys, whose stories have come before us and whose stories will continue to be told after us. Sovereignty was never ceded here.
7,817,247, representing 61.6%.
I still find, like, walking around, you see the little yes posters in people's windows, even like rainbow flags around the place still carry traces of that movement or that campaign to me. And the language of the campaign as well, the idea of yes and no, and that being imbued with so much meaning.
The survey was filled with hate and vitriol that targeted our LGBT community with a public intensity I quite seen outside of the survey. It also raised extremely uncomfortable situations for LGBT religious people and LGBT people of colour who live in communities where more traditional and conservative values are common. Many of my friends, both white and non-white, reported the rates of harassment to grow much higher during the postal survey. Many LGBT people of colour in communities where more traditional values are held felt incredibly torn and uncomfortable. And during the postal survey debate, many white people went out of their way to complain or attack religious communities of colour, i.e. Muslim communities, in response. Overall, the postal survey allowed for blatant homophobia and racism to emerge. It was terrible, really outrageous, depressing. It led to depression and conflict. The more marginalised you were, the worse it was. As for a person from a refugee background, the time during the survey was highly trauma-triggering. I came from the country that allowed public hate to Australia to be safe. Yet, in Australia, almost the situation was occurring. Additionally, I think that there were not enough discussions among cowed communities. I know about services who were adopting the organisational policies not to speak about this at all, in order not to upset other people. Simultaneously, mainstream marriage equality campaigning was really white. I felt thrown under the bus twice. I think that in mainstream LGBTIQA plus communities are not yet attentive to issues of race, culture, ethnicity, religion, migration and refugee status. More work needs to be done in that regard.
One year on from winning the marriage postal survey, many people from the LGBTIQ community were celebrating across the country. Books were published, documentaries made, and parties were thrown at every well-known queer bar across the country. A year on, we still see remnants of the Yes campaign on t-shirts, shoes, beer stubbies, and even the rainbow poster with Yes printed across it. I'm Tan Hung Pham, and you're listening to When Love Wins, stories where queer people of colour share with us their lives during the Australian Marriage Postal Survey. On the year anniversary of the postal survey, Sophie Chohan went to Honcho Disco, a queer performance night at the 86 Bar on Smith Street in Collingwood, Melbourne.
My name's Sophie Chohan. I'm 20 years old. I live in Melbourne or Nam. I've lived here since 2006. Before then, I lived in London. I was born there. I have two brothers. Both of my parents were also born in England, but my dad's parents migrated from India, from Punjab originally and Rajasthan, during the 60s, before my dad was born. My mum is white English, so I'm a mixed race young woman, a lesbian, a student. I work in the youth sector, community development. I think it was around about the year anniversary of the Postal Survey announcement. I was with some of my closest friends in the 86 on Smith Street. And above the bar, they had these little, like those things you get at Kmart, the letters with the lights on them. It says yes above the bar. And obviously that's a little remnant, like a little like relic of this process that is really absurd to think that something so simple has all of this meaning and emotion and I guess a point in history attached to it that I can't imagine explaining to someone in 50 years' time, like a young person, to say yes means something so much more to people who live through this. But it does, and it's kind of echoing all over the place.
So what does yes mean to you?
That's a funny way to think of it, but yes to me, it's so absolute, isn't it? Like, and as someone who sits in the like maybe camp about marriage equality, in that I describe my politics as being like marriage abolitionist, yes has an element of like sheen and optimism, and I almost attach it to that like corporate image of this campaign about like GTMs and like rainbow volleys and Levi's and absolute vodka kind of stuff, that it's almost a like sanitized Glee episode yes kind of thing, you know? Yeah. I don't think the answer to any question is that simple. So in that way, it's a little bit alienating.
After the party has died down, who is left out of the celebration? Is the queer community standing up and supporting issues that impact Aboriginal and or Torres Strait Islanders, people of colour, refugees, and migrants? The Postal Survey allowed discrimination and hate messages against the LGBTIQ community to air nationally. And after the results were announced, there was a huge media focus on the electorates that voted no. In particular, the ones that contained a large population of ethnic minorities. Where was the queer community when hate messages against ethnic minorities arose in the no electorates? Sophie is out to her parents, but she has no desire to come out to one of the most important people in her life, her grandpa. Among the devastating and hate-inspired conversations that were happening during the postal survey, Sophie's grandpa had a surprise for her.
My grandfather is, I think he turned 84 recently. He was born in Delhi. He's lived through, to me, like incommensurable amount of history. He witnessed partition. He was at Gandhi's funeral.
Whoa.
Like, yeah. He's such a brilliant storyteller too. But I just have all of these little pieces of his life in India, his experience of migrating to Britain in the 60s, in the kind of like Enoch Powell Rivers of Blood era, of raising my dad and then my dad's experiences as well. And he now lives in Australia. He lives in Melbourne, has done for about 5 or 6 years because my dad's an only child and my grandmother passed away 17 years ago. So he came to be with his family in Australia. When I think of all of this, like history that's piled up in this one person and all of his potential, all the weight that that gives to his judgments or interpretations or readings of things, and the fact that his reading of Western expressions of queerness has just never been cultivated through all of that, and how that makes me unfamiliar to him in a lot of respects, but enables this closeness based on what we can relate on and what we do share with each other. That comes from him sharing stories and experiences. I give a huge amount of value to this relationship, and our connection is very important to me. And that being said, I have absolutely no idea if he has, like, firstly ever, like, properly thought about gay people or what it means to be gay. I think on top of that, ever properly thought about, like, lesbians or what that means, because I guess at least in his lifetime, that's been like less culturally prominent as scandal or like even a phenomenon that people encounter. And obviously in terms of like my presentation and how he reads my butchness, that he attaches no meaning to that means that I have absolutely no clue what he would think if I were to come out. And that's the main reason, I guess, why I don't feel any imperative to. I don't feel that our relationship lacks anything, because I'm a big believer in distributing need and types of attachment across relationships. I have like queer family and friends and networks who I share that with. And what I share with him is really unique. I don't intend to ever be out to him because I think the concern or confusion it would cause him isn't worth any kind of idea of closeness that it could bring. What the marriage equality era kind of brought up for so many people was having those conversations for the first time, or hearing those opinions or insights or commentary that you've never had a reason to like deal with or process before. So in terms of our direct interactions, I never witnessed this. But what did happen was my dad and my older brother were in the car one day, and my grandfather gets, whenever he needs to come into the city, he gets public transport. And he had gotten public transport and he had passed people who were protesting. I think it was probably a small scale thing, marriage equality protest, something along those lines. And what he said was to my dad and my brother, he's like, oh, I was in the city the other day and I saw these people protesting, you know, something about marriage. And the two of them told me this story later. Ned said that they were both so tense and so stressed, because it's kind of like a Schrodinger's homophobe situation. You don't know until he said like what he could possibly be thinking, because there's no indication in the past of what could be going on there. And they're both sitting there really tense, like not sure what to say. So they just wait to hear how he continues. And he just goes, you know, all this stuff about the marriage, they should just let him have it. And my dad and
such
brother
a good
report, like this strong sense of relief. And a funny thing about that is none of us know if he understood what the protest was about, how much he had thought about that, how much media he's been exposed to, whether he's considered its implications for his own life or his family or any reality that's close to him. We can't know, probably never will know, hopefully never will know, the extent to which he's thought about that. But for such a flippant little remark to kind of remind us that this can be something that's irrelevant in a time when it's being made front and center of every conversation and every relationship, seemingly, is such a relief.
And how did it feel for you to hear that story? Because you weren't in the car when it happened.
No,
this
I
is told
there.
To you later. Yeah.
I know the weight of relatives' opinions can sway people's lives so dramatically. It swayed my life in the past to a huge extent. And in particular, like, that was the intent of this process. This postal survey, I think, was intended to bring those views out of the woodwork and allow them to have devastating, extreme, intense effects on people's lives. So to hear an opinion from someone who's so close to me and so important to me, and just be able to laugh about it, to get on with my life, to think, isn't that just like a funny little thing, is really rare and kind of precious because of that. That it's allowed to just be a little moment rather than something that dictates our relationship.
In May 2017, the Uluru Statement from the Heart was released just months prior to the Marriage Postal Survey. The statement is the latest step in a long-running debate on constitutional reforms relating to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and what such reforms might look like. It was created and is led by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders. We hear how the Marriage Postal Survey distracted our country from recognising the sovereignty of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in this country. Samia is a Bundjalung Aboriginal First Nations queer woman. She is a published poet, writer and filmmaker, and currently is Associate Professor at the University of Canberra in the School of Arts and Design, where she is teaching Indigenous Studies.
The timing of it was very, very interesting.
Mm.
Because as an Aboriginal person, it coincided with the Statement from the Heart and the research and consultation that had been going on for nearly a decade at looking at what might be needed to have constitutional recognition. And that accumulated with the meeting with a lot of Aboriginal representatives, probably the biggest gathering of diverse Aboriginal community representatives that's happened since settlement at Uluru, and then the statement from the heart was released with the findings in a public document. All of that happened, and it was given to Turnbull at the same time as the marriage plebiscite discussion started happening. So he actually didn't look at it really, and it just sort of went and slid off the shelf, and nobody really noticed because everyone was caught up into the marriage plebiscite. So that caused in the Aboriginal community quite a lot of mixed reactions. A lot of Aboriginal people who might have been supportive and would say that they are supportive of LGBTQI issues and people in general and the marriage plebiscite, etc., were really upset that a whole lot of money and time and political effort and conversation was going on into that instead of into yet again a really big Indigenous issue that should have been getting the focus. And I think in general that most people just felt like that it was important that it was just being used politically and that it was going to be, which we're used to as Aboriginal people, a tick in the box, like, okay, we've dealt with this and now it's all okay.
Can you give can you maybe describe a moment or a particular, a moment where you kind of experienced this, like maybe had a conversation with someone about it, or when you found out the news, how you found out the news of the plebiscite being happening at the same time
as
the statement?
Oh, it was all over Facebook. So, you know, the news that the plebiscite, would it go ahead, wouldn't it go ahead? Oh, yes, it is going to go ahead. All of that was happening and the debate around that was happening. And then on Facebook, I started to see some Aboriginal people being quite vitriolic and going, oh, yeah, right, spend a whole lot of money on gays, but we're like, what about us? There was that kind of stuff happening, and then people saying, well, hang on a minute, like, I'm gay and these issues are just as important. And then people saying, yes, they're important, but they've completely overshadowed our issues. And then people saying, how come all these people come out and protest for equal rights and see it as being important? Where are all those people around this issue for us? And it's just sort of fallen off the table and nobody's even noticed. There was a lot of threats with those different themes. And I was like reading them going, wow, this is really interesting for me as an Aboriginal woman who's queer and I don't necessarily want to or need to get married, but everybody should have the right to. Most of my gay, queer friends, etc., thought it was a waste of money as well and put a lot of people through a lot of homophobic comments from people and put the issue in their face. I had friends who were non-Aboriginal friends and they were really, really, really upset about how it was impacting them. And I found that really interesting because as an Aboriginal person, it was like, well, didn't really impact me like that because that stuff happens all the time every day in my world.
I'd love to hear more about how it made you feel, especially you having these intersections of identities.
I think I could see that it was impacting me in terms of like also being older and watching younger people be really passionate about it and then not being, I think, as affected as much by non-Aboriginal people I knew who were a little bit younger than me or my age who felt really impacted by the publicness of it and the fact that there had to be a plebiscite which they thought was going to bring into the open more homophobia and that it wouldn't get through and, you know, those kind of things. Whereas for me it was like I was just sort of sitting there watching it and going, well, in my generation we've always had to deal with that anyway and homophobia's always been there and probably always will be. Mm. And to me, it was a little bit like the vote for the referendum of becoming a citizen in my own country. So I guess that intersectionality is really the interesting place for me and probably for other people of colour as well.
While the postal survey forced people from the LGBTIQ community to come out to their friends and family, conversations around the postal survey also highlighted privileges within the queer community. During the postal survey, Samia noticed how privileged some of her white queer friends were.
A lot of my white friends, that's all they'd had to deal with in terms of being treated differently, was experiencing homophobia, not racism. I had one friend who was completely traumatised by it. She was a non-Aboriginal woman who's quite privileged. The friend I'm talking about, who is probably in her 30s, like mid-30s, really privileged background, highly educated, very out in her life.
Okay.
Really goes to a lot of, you know, like the lesbian choir, and, you know, has an identity that's quite strong within the community, whereas I don't kind of see it as a community. I see lots of different communities and I don't even necessarily feel like I belong to one in specific, whereas she's got a very strong identity that way. And she was literally devastated and would call me and say, I'm so devastated about this plebiscite. It's really impacting me. I'm really depressed. And I kind of surprised. It was kind of like, oh, okay, really? It didn't impact me in that same way at all. And I think I just was more, I sort of took a bit of a back seat because of the Aboriginal stuff that was happening at the same time. And I kind of was like, well, to me it doesn't make one difference or another because the world will still either love me or hate me.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow. Can you describe to me, like, the feeling you felt when this friend who's quite privileged spoke to you about how the plebiscite impacted her?
You know, I got it on another level, but I felt like, oh, it takes something like this to impact you before you maybe have some understanding or empathy of what it's like to deal with racism every day, because I'd actually felt like at times that she was quite unsympathetic to the reality of that. I had to sort of hold myself back a little bit from, because I knew she was distressed, to sort of go, well, see, now you know what it's like.
Yeah.
Do you think that makes sense?
Yeah. Do you think even had an understanding of what was going on, I guess, in terms of Aboriginal issues?
No. I think that it just bypassed people completely. And what I found interesting was that, you know, it's often what you see is a lot of white culture, white colour, whatever, but white people who think that they're educated, that they know what the issues are, that they're empathetic, but I'd say they're more sympathetic than empathetic, have a bit of a saviour complex, think they know what the issues are, think that they're not racist, you know, think that they're being supportive, and in a lot of ways actually do nothing.
Conversations were happening on a personal level, among friends and families. But what conversations were happening in schools with young people? Amal spoke with us about how these conversations affected her and her young nephew.
What can I do for my own community? What kind of legacy can I give back, or what can I do in hopes that, you know, the future generations, that their pathway is a lot more easier? My name is Amal Leotolu. I'm a proud Samoan Fafafine trans woman of colour. A lot of my stuff is to do with performance, using intersectionality of age, gender, race, culture in my public speaking and also my performance works. I had a situation where a nephew of mine who's of a different culture had gone to school, and what had come up was a situation where he was blatantly asked about the relationship that I had with his uncle. What kind of, you know, if I can say, faggot relationship? Is your uncle a faggot? And there was a fight.
Yep.
It entailed to have to explain or validate my relationship with my partner at the time. To even be asked about it was quite heavy, was quite mentally, it was quite upsetting for myself to find the fact that someone had to judge who I was and just try and validate that, you know, around the thing of marriage equality. This is actually nobody else's business but mine and my ex-partner. And it wasn't a small fight. It involved a few, 4 to 5 kids.
Oh, who ganged up on your nephew?
One of the friends was standing up for my nephew.
Yeah.
And the other three were on the opposing side. Mm. You know, this was around the marriage equality stuff.
Right.
Someone's asking you, what's your auntie? Is she a he? Or just to have that and then have to be dragged into school. I get a call to come in. It was almost like someone's trying to out you and I'm being dragged into it. I found it hard to comprehend because I couldn't understand why people were so interested in our relationships, were so interested in GLBTIQ. They never were interested in it before, so why be interested in it now?
It seemed like this fight that your nephew got in was suddenly like, oh, people are asking these questions outwardly without even thinking of the consequences.
For my nephew, he was standing his ground, loves his auntie, myself very much. And so he was just standing up for myself. You know, like I was shocked that it happened. But then, you know, I thought to myself, that's how the world is at the moment. The trans community, basically, I felt also got dragged under that bus because there was also a lot of trans stuff that came out in that debate. And it was just so unnecessary, besides being a person of colour.
Yes.
For me, it was like a double whammy, and to have to be on my guard, even where I was working, going out in public and being able to just go and do shopping or, you know, like even go to school, you know, even to go pick up my nephew, people staring at me. Mentally, those were quite huge things to deal with on a day-to-day basis. Nobody else knew because all we saw was visions of white people in the media taking the mic, taking control. And there's this other community that's voices of silence, and they're having to deal with the crap that's being dealt at.
I guess the story of your nephew, what stood out for me so much is that it was you being affected by it, but it was also him.
Yeah.
Being exposed to that level of transphobia, essentially. Yeah.
Even just the hate.
Yes, the hate, like the naming hate. It for what it is.
Like
yes.
On his locker, it was sprayed, oh, your auntie's a faggot.
Oh my gosh.
You and know,
was that leading up to the fight? Or
That was a day after.
After the fight.
Yeah.
Even people decide.
Yeah, so like my nephew, we were thinking of pulling my nephew out of school, but because he had a few friends there, we felt it worked in his favour. But, you know, to target him because of who I was.
Yes.
It's so not cool. Like, you just, why? Like, he's never had a problem with him before.
That's right.
Why is it an issue? And I said, you see me when we go to pick him up or whatever.
You see me all the time.
Yeah, it's never been an issue.
Right.
So all of a sudden, it's become an issue.
You mentioned that they were getting suspended.
Yeah.
Is that right? Could you talk through that and what happened when you got called into the teacher's office?
That was a difficult conversation to have because it was almost like you're almost having to give your reasons why your nephew has done what he's done. And it's just trying to find a respectful way to not make such a major issue, even though it was. There was a feeling of embarrassment for me. Like, it's tiring to explain your story when you haven't invited people. I was in two minds. I was just like, open up with what I can, but also educate them. that was the best that I could do. That was the best stuff that I could give them and show my solidarity to my nephew in my heart of hearts. I was so proud of my nephew because I just said, it's what we've always taught you, is just be good to people and you stand up for people as well. And so he's seen what I've gone through, or he's seen the crap. I think it's made him, like myself, a resilient person, but also to stand up for the underdog. And so we try to encourage the kids to do that, but also to be loving as well, because I said, that's a hard thing to do, but that's where I come from. That's the way I was brought up. And for me, it's a cultural thing. Being Samoan is just that no matter what negativity is throwing you your way, you give off service and you be able to give off love. It's such a Samoan thing.
In January 2019, Amal was invited to be on the front cover of Midsummer's Program Guide, one of Australia's largest LGBTIQ festivals. This was a huge step forward for not only the queer community, but also every young trans person of colour looking to see themselves represented in the LGBTIQ community. The Marriage Postal Survey sparked a surge of conversations across the country. Now that the celebrations are over, what issues will the LGBTIQ community address on the table? Queer people of colour and queer Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders are driving important conversations after the Marriage Postal Survey. We're not waiting for the LGBTIQ community to invite us to the table. We're taking the step to invite ourselves to the conversations that concern our lives.
I look at inviting myself to the table, you know, being a person of whawhawhine, trans woman of colour, not necessarily kind of the look or whatever that people want to have at their table. However, so I feel that my narrative and my story is important. I don't wish to be silent. I that was me back in the 80s as a young gay boy, shy gay Samoan child. Whereas now it's just like, no, you know, I deserve, my story is just as important as the white person's story. And so are all my other people of colour comrades. Their stories are just important. People need to know our narratives. People need to know what we go through. People need to know what we experience, what makes us tick. You know, they could probably take something from our books, you know, seeing something different from our angles. I mean, you know, one of the beautiful examples that I saw from people of colour, and this is just across the border, the stuff in New Zealand.
Yes.
And the beautiful cross cultures that were involved in supporting our Muslim brothers, sisters, and all unique others. You know, that's an example. I said, yeah, you just get on and do it, but you just, this white culture could see things from a different perspective. And so for me to invite myself to the table is to actually take ownership of my own, you know, story, to take ownership and not have a white person speak on behalf of me, you know, to have a white person not be able to give out information that, you know, is pretending. I just said, no, that's my story and you need to hear it from me.
You've been listening to our podcast, When Love Wins. And alas, this is our last episode for the series. If you've just tuned in now, then make sure you listen back to our last three episodes. Thank you to all our guests who shared their stories with us. Zakaria, Maddie, Nika, Yasmin, Sam, Brian, Chuping, Peter, Sophie, Samia, and Amal. Your generosity made this podcast possible. Thank you to you, our listeners, for supporting When Love Wins. If you enjoyed this series, please tell your friends and share your feedback with us on social media with the hashtag When Love Wins Podcast. We would love to hear from you. I'm Tan Hung Pham, and you've been listening to When Love Wins, stories where queer people of colour share with us their lives during the Marriage Postal Survey.
When Love Wins is a podcast produced by Switchboard and funded by the Victorian State Government. Switchboard Victoria provides peer-driven support services for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender and gender diverse, intersex, queer and asexual people, their families, allies and communities. Our host and producer was Tan Hung Pham, and our project coordinator was Caroline Ridler. In November 2018, Switchboard put out a survey to hear from queer people of colour about their experience of the Australian Marriage Postal Survey. The results were read aloud on this podcast by Rebecca Robertson and Shamita Siva.
Thanks for listening. This podcast has been produced by Switchboard with the support of the Victorian Government. To find out more, visit switchboard.org.au.